KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The coronavirus pandemic has exposed the United States, the richest nation on the planet, as actually one of the weakest countries. Unemployment is sky high, while billionaires increased their collective wealth by more than $1 trillion in 1 year alone. We have the highest numbers of infections and deaths in the world. Now, as per a new book by my guest Tom Hartman, the U.S. has always had a tension between the forces of democracy and oligarchy. Tom Hartman is a renowned progressive radio talk show host, New York Times bestselling author who's written more than 24 books, including several that are part of his new Hidden History series. He joins me to discuss his latest book called The Hidden History of American Oligarchy, Reclaiming Our Democracy from the Ruling Class. Welcome to the program, Tom.
Hey, Sonali. Thanks so much for having me on.
So perhaps no one has introduced the word oligarchy to the American public as a whole, as much as Senator Bernie Sanders. Maybe you might come second to him, but he has used that word and he repeatedly used it not only during his presidential campaigns, but also just in general, talking about corporate oligarchy. What exactly is oligarchy? How do you define that word to our audience, and specifically, how do you define American oligarchy?
Well, oligarchy is when you have, the simple definition would be rule by the rich, but you know, to tighten it up a little bit, much like monopoly is where a small number of players gain basically concentrated control over wealth in an economy or over the economic structure. Oligarchy is where a small number of players gain control over the political structure of a nation, and typically very wealthy players, oligarchs. And one of the signal characteristics of an oligarchy is that the government no longer works for the people. And this is something we're very much there right now. Back in 2014, two researchers from Princeton and Northwestern University, Ben Page and Matthew Gillens, published a brilliant study that looked at public opinion polls regarding public policy matters and actual legislative outcomes before and after the Reagan Revolution. And when you look at what the majority of people want in terms of policy outcomes, in terms of legislation, pre-Ronald Reagan, what you find is that it typically gets made into law. This is how we got the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, Medicare, Medicaid, long-term unemployment, food stamps, housing support, Pell Grants for college. I could go on for a long, long time. Those things all happened because the majority of the people wanted them to happen. Post-Reagan Revolution, that connection between what the majority of people want and what actually gets made into law, which arguably is the primary definition of a democracy, that connection was broken, has been broken, to the point that by 2014 or even by 2005 from their research, there is literally no association between what the majority of Americans want and what gets passed into law. None whatsoever. In fact, they characterize it as a statistical association equivalent to random noise. However, the association between what the very rich want and what gets made into law, while a weak association back prior to the Reagan administration, is the only measurable association now, and regularly what the rich want, like $2 trillion in tax cuts from Donald Trump, is exactly what they get. And the problem with this is that because of this, oligarchies tend to be unstable. Our oligarchy right now is very unstable. We're watching it all around us. Donald Trump ran against the oligarchy. He promised that he was going to bring the jobs back. He was going to give everybody health care and it was going to be really cheap. And he was going to tax the bejeezies out of the rich. He was lying through his teeth, of course. You know, he basically stole Bernie's platform. But, you know, people were like, yes, stop the oligarchy. But they put an oligarch in charge. So typically what happens when democracies turn into oligarchies, and we've seen examples of this around the world, particularly over the last 100 years, when democracies turn into oligarchies, in a fairly short period of time, typically within a generation, one of two things happens. Either the democracy fights back and puts the oligarchs back in the bottle, which is what we did in 1865, and it's what we did in the 1930s, or the oligarchs overwhelm and subsume the democracy and the democratic process and put into place a police state to enforce their rule, because oligarchy is not popular. And once it becomes, you know, really, really visible, people start protesting. And we're seeing that right now in Hungary, we're seeing it in Russia, we're seeing it, you know, all over the world. Belarus is one of the more recent examples where the oligarchs rise to power. And then when the people start protesting, suddenly people start being put in jail. The police state has emerged. It's happening in the Philippines. It's happening in Brazil right now. It's happening in Venezuela. Over and over and over again, we've seen this transition. And that's why this is such a critical pivot point right now for the United States.
Now, you are often have a lot of your analysis rooted in history, not just history of the past few decades, but history of the origins of this country. And you write about that in your book, how the United States was really formed in the, you know, as part of the struggle against British oligarchy, British aristocracy. You would have thought, and at least if you maybe believe the rhetoric, that the resulting country was symbolized by being anti-oligarchy. Why didn't that happen? Why didn't it turn out that way?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right. We fought a war against the, you know, a monarchy, which is just another form of oligarchy. It's just that you have one lineal, one family, essentially, that dominates the oligarchy, and thus the monarchs. And we succeeded, you know, in the 1770s and early 1780s in fighting that war. What happened next was fascinating. The rise of oligarchy in the United States that happened starting really in a big way in the late 1820s, early 1830s, was the result of a technological innovation. For the cotton producers in the South, the giant bottleneck in cotton production wasn't growing it or shipping it. It was in removing the seeds from it. Cotton comes with these fairly large seeds that the cotton fibers interpenetrate. And so picking those seeds out of the cotton was a really slow process. Eli Whitney in 1798 invented the cotton gin, which was like a giant drum with like a screen, and it had these little hooks that went through it that would pull the cotton fibers out and it would leave the seeds behind. One cotton gin could do the work of 50 enslaved people. But it was a very expensive machine. They really hit the marketplace around 1810. And so the large plantations in the South in the period from 1810 to 1830 were able to buy these machines, become literally 50 times more productive at producing cotton than the smaller cotton farms all around them, drop the price of cotton, wipe out their competition, buy them up, turn them into essentially sharecroppers. And they then became the new oligarchy. By the 1840s, the politics of the southern states, state by state, were dominated by just a few thousand families who owned these massive plantations. And they were very unhappy about the fact that there was democracy, a functioning democracy, north of the Mason-Dixon line. And it was causing problems for them, unrest, among other things. So they declared a war on us. And, you know, we fought back and we won that war, and we put the oligarchs in a bottle. We broke up the plantations. One of the largest in Louisiana, for example, Parchment's plantation is now a state prison. One of the largest in Virginia, you know, probably one of the 10 largest in the country, is Robert E. Lee's. That's now Arlington National Cemetery. We basically took it away from them. The second rise of oligarchy in the United States in a big way was, again, the result of technological innovation, which was the Industrial Revolution, which happened in the 1880s, 1890s, you know, early 20th century, and brought about, you know, the Carnegies and the Rockefellers and the Astors and the Martins and, you know, on and on. And those oligarchs, there was a pushback against them by the progressive Republicans, Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft, but it was only a holding effort. They did not succeed in defeating them. And with the election of Warren Harding in 1920, the oligarchs came roaring back with the Roaring Twenties, when the rich got massively richer and working people saw that their incomes declined substantially during that 9-year period from 1920 to 29. They, of course, the oligarchs crashed the economy, which provided a space for Franklin Roosevelt to come in. The oligarchs declared war on him. They recruited over 100,000 people from a right-wing veterans group to march on the White House and seize and either imprison, kidnap, or kill Franklin Roosevelt. And the mistake they made was going to the most famous Marine general at that time in history, Smedley Butler, the hero of World War I and the Spanish-American War, and asking if he would lead the effort. And he turned him in. And this is sometimes referred to as the businessman's conspiracy. It created a brief flurry of activity. Congress started to look into it, but FDR put a cap on it. But FDR openly challenged the oligarchs. Read his 1936 acceptance speech of his renomination. It's mind-boggling. He calls them out. He said, we have to overthrow this kind of power. Literally, he used the word overthrow, calls for its overthrow. And so he beat back the oligarchs and put them back in a bottle. And they stayed there until the 1970s when the Supreme Court opened that bottle in 76 and 78 with the Buckley and Bilotti decisions, in which the Supreme Court said, oh, if a billionaire or a corporation wants to own a politician and the politician dances pretty much to the tune of that billionaire or oligarch, we used to call that corruption and bribery. We're not going to do that anymore. We're going to call that free speech.
And you wrote a whole book about the Supreme Court and the hidden history of the Supreme Court. And you and I talked about some of the ways in which the Supreme Court, unfortunately, has worked to subvert the Constitution and subvert democracy. Tom, I want to just sort of step back and ask you to explain why there is this sort of cultural or even sort of propaganda-filled discourse around democracy that's relegated as, you know, it's idealistic to expect democracy to truly function perfectly, and that it's only natural for the wealthy, the powerful, the elites to be making decisions for the rest of us, and that, you know, if we want to join the ruling class, we just have to work hard enough. It's a pretty insidious and well sort of, you know, it's a kind of propaganda that has established itself very deep into the American psyche.
Well, that's their sales pitch, and you nailed it, Sonali. It's absolutely their sales pitch, and at a deep level, I think a lot of people have internalized it. There are a lot of authoritarian follower types who, because of the way they were brought up, in all probability, there's still debate about, you know, what makes an authoritarian follower, who are, you know, just desperately hoping that Big Daddy will come along, you know, somebody will come along and protect them and save them and make everything good again. And that's what Donald Trump, you know, I alone will save the country. I alone can fix it. So, you know, here we are. After the Supreme Court did what they did in the 70s, that brought Reagan in on a tsunami of cash. And we've been on this path for 40 years now toward increasing oligarchy. And it's either going to break or it's going to break us.
So when we look at the way in which oligarchies and governments or societies that are in the grip of oligarchs are unstable, I want to pick up on what you said earlier. There's this instability, and we've just been through this wild four-year ride here in the United States that is a bit of a preview of the things we've seen unfolding in some other countries. Looking at that and considering the fact that, you know, 70 plus million Americans voted for Donald Trump, do you foresee more such political instability in the United States? And how much depends on what Democrats who claim they're against oligarchy do in the next 2 years?
The most toxic poison to democracy is cynicism. And, you know, what you identified a few minutes ago about that, you know, the sales pitch about, you know, that the oligarchs are giving the average person is designed to fuel cynicism. And the extent to which cynicism rules largely as a consequence of people not getting what they want is a measure of how much power the oligarchs will continue to have. So right now, if Joe Biden and the Democrats in Congress can actually make American government work for the people in a way that it has not since the late 1980s, early 1990s, if they can make government work for the people, it can wipe out a lot of that cynicism, restore belief in at least, you know, the idea of democracy in America, and put us on a path to rejecting oligarchy. On the other hand, if they fail, then we're screwed. We're in big trouble. And this is why I'm encouraging everybody to call Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and every other Democratic senator and tell them that we have to end the filibuster right now, because the Republicans are going to use the filibuster to try to defeat everything the Democrats do. You know, they're only going to be able this year to pass one or two pieces of legislation by reconciliation. And the first is going to be this COVID relief. And there's really vital stuff that needs to be passed to restore a functioning democracy in this country. And as long as there's a filibuster, the Republicans are going to block it.
And not only does an oligarchy, of course, make for an incredibly unstable government, it also makes us deeply vulnerable, doesn't it, to disasters like the coronavirus pandemic. I mean, you and I and sort of ordinary Americans might not have seen this coming, but the government was made aware, as they should be made aware, that a coronavirus type of pandemic was utterly predictable. And of course, we had the worst possible president at the worst possible time in this nation. And we've seen now going on nearly 500,000 deaths here in this country. It weakens our country, doesn't it, to such a great extent, to have oligarchs running the country, those who are minting money at the same time that we're losing it?
It very much does. And, you know, another one of the typical characteristics of an oligarchy is that the wealth of the nation is converted into the wealth of the oligarchs. You know, the GAO just issued a report, I believe it's in the New York Times now, about how literally tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars entire agency budgets have just like money has gone, you know, during the Trump administration. They don't know where it went. You know, hundreds of millions of dollars was allocated for this or for that, and it just went somewhere. Nobody knows where. Again, it gets back to, we need to make our democracy, we need to make our nation work for all the people, not just for the top 1%.
So when we are examining the model that other countries might offer, what is the path that you think America needs to take to get away from oligarchy? And also, how do we sort of take on our own unique challenges, our own unique cultural challenges in this country? Because when you have a figure like Bernie Sanders discussing the corporate oligarchy that controls our nation, it resounds across the political spectrum quite deeply. And we still, unfortunately, don't have enough people like him, although the ranks are growing a little bit in the House of people willing to call out corporatism and corporate domination. What are the ways in which America can work itself out of our oligarchy and toward a stronger democracy?
We have defeated oligarchy in this country, internal oligarchs. We have defeated them twice in a big way. And I think there's lessons from both of those. The first thing you must do is absolutely identify and devastate the instruments of the oligarchy. And in this case, that means go after all the people who were complicit in the Trump administration's looting of America. Aggressive prosecutions, lots of public statements, just make it right out there in the open. No more Mr. Nice Guy. When we failed to do that, when Lincoln was assassinated and his slave-owning vice president, Andrew Johnson, who was of the opposite political party, became president, he basically stopped the forward progress, you know, and pardoned the Confederacy. Which I think is a large chunk of why that ideology still exists to today. But you've got to crush it, number one. And then secondly, what the lesson that we learned from FDR is you must make government work for the people. And that has to be job one. You know, he, in his first 100 days, all the things that FDR did, putting millions of people back to work with the WPA and the CCC and all these other things. And you have to change your tax structure so it's harder to become an oligarch and harder to retain your status as an oligarch. Typically countries that have succeeded in in not being dominated by oligarchs, which the ones principally that I would point to are the Northern European countries, have done that by having a top tax bracket that's well north of 50%. And we haven't been there since the mid-1980s when Reagan dropped the top tax break rate down to 25% from the 74% where LBJ had put it. And it was 91% during the Eisenhower and Kennedy and Nixon and all those administrations right up until Johnson. So, you know, we got a lot of work to do.
There is, you know, part of the takeover of the oligarchy is privatization of public, the public, you know, goods and services. And you write in your book, I want to sort of draw out one very specific story, which is the way in which the postal service has been deeply hampered by years ago, a law that required them to prepay retirement benefits and many years worth of retirement benefits. But we now see the Democrats have just introduced a bill undoing that or trying to undo that. Is that a step in the right direction on at least one narrow issue?
It would be. Joe Biden also needs to fire the entire Postal Board of Governors for cause and fire Louis DeJoy because they've all been working toward privatizing the post office. There's long been a push to privatize the post office, mostly coming from UPS and FedEx and interests like that, although there's ideologues, you know, right-wing billionaires who call themselves libertarians, who also don't think that government should be doing basically anything except running the military. But it really kicked into high gear in 2005. In 2005, the post office, with much fanfare, rolled out that they were going to electrify their fleet. The post office has the largest fleet of vehicles in the United States. They're also the largest unionized employer in the United States. Well, when they did that, the oil oligarchs went nuts. And that led right to that legislation that you're talking about in 2005 that required the post office to set aside $5 billion every year to pay for the health benefits. This is assuming that in the future there won't be a national healthcare program to pay for the health benefits of people who retire 75 years in the future, people who are not even born yet. We have to set aside this money. And that kneecapped the post office badly. There's almost $50 billion now in this trust fund for the year 2200 and more or less. And it should be freed. The post office needs that money. And we need to, to block that or get rid of that ball and chain around its ankle.
Well, Tom, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Any more books coming forth in the Hidden History series?
Yeah, the next one, which just went off to the publisher, is The Hidden History of American Healthcare. Why is it that we're the only country of the 34 OECD countries, the only developed country in the world that doesn't have a national healthcare system? Sneak preview, it's the racism. And it was shocking what I learned when I researched that book. So that'll be the next one in the series.
Wow. Well, I look forward to it and to have you back on the program when that book is out. Thanks so much, Tom, for all you do and for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Sonali. It's always wonderful talking with you.
My guest has been Tom Hartmann, renowned progressive radio talk show host, New York Times bestselling author. He's written more than 24 books, including several that are part of his new Hidden History series. We've just been discussing his latest book in that series called The Hidden History of American Oligarchy, Reclaiming Our Democracy from the Ruling Class. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.